a downgrade of two French banks,
and more signs Europe may be close to a full-blown debt crisis.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles. Hello, I'm Steve Chiotakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's the Marketplace Midday Update, our podcast from Marketplace.org. Today is Wednesday, September 14th.
Well, coming up, wholesale prices and retail sales went nowhere last month.
Bill Gates says we should be spending a whole lot more on our energy future.
And author J.D. Salinger kept out of the spotlight, of course, and apparently didn't know how to charm his employees either.
That story and others on the Marketplace Midday Update from APM, American Public Media.
Don't miss the numbers, the news, and Kai's final note. Subscribe to the Marketplace podcast. Find it on iTunes or online at marketplace.org/podcasts.
U.S. Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner will travel to Europe later this week, and he'll do something American cabinet members rarely do, attend a meeting of European finance ministers. Today, Moody's downgraded the credit ratings of two of France's biggest banks, Societe Generale and Crédit Agricole, because of their exposure to debt problems in Greece, Italy, and Spain.
Also today, the German, French, and Greek leaders are holding urgent talks about fears that Greece is about to default on its debts. The BBC's Christian Fraser is with us now from Paris with the latest. Hi, Christian.
Hello.
What kind of an impact will the French banks' credit downgrades have in France?
I think they've already paid the price, to be honest. We've seen share prices tumbling to their lowest level since 2009, down almost 50% over the summer, because there have been these concerns for some time about their exposure to the debts of Greece, Italy and Spain. And that is reflected in today's decision to downgrade them, albeit that it's not as bad as it could have been. They were only pulled down one notch. And obviously the French government is trying to put a positive spin on it.
The leaders of France and Germany, Christian, are having this conference call with the Greek prime minister. Has anything come out of that yet? And what is the French president Sarkozy going to be saying to leaders of Greece?
We're told they're in constant communication with the Greek prime minister, but the concern of both the German chancellor and the French president is that they're not meeting their targets that were set for them in June. It's very difficult for the Greek prime minister because he is battling very strong public sector unions. But, for instance, they were expected to sell off public assets to raise 1.7 billion euros, and they've only raised 400 million. So there's a big shortfall. And what is at stake here is the next tranche of this bailout money that Greece needs to pay public sector salaries and its pensions. If they can't convince the eurozone that they are stepping up to the plate, then obviously there is the very serious risk of a default.
We know that the German people aren't very happy about bailing out Greece, but what do French people think about this eurozone crisis?
Well, obviously the epicenter is Greece, but the reverberations are being felt now quite acutely in the French economy. And the big challenge for the French president is convincing not only the markets, but his own public 6 months from an election that Greece can be saved, but that it won't impinge or impact on the French economy. And that's not an easy one to pull off. So the way he handles this crisis over the next month will in some way impact on his election campaign. So there's a lot at stake for him, not just in terms of the economy, but also politically as well.
The BBC's Christian Fraser in Paris. Christian, thanks.
You're welcome.
Let's get another take on the European debt crisis. We're joined by Josh Brown of Fusion Analytics, our new Wednesday regular. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Josh, Moody's downgraded two French banks this morning, saying they are too exposed to Greek debt and don't have enough cash. Is this crisis spiraling out of control?
You know, I want to say it's spiraling out of control just by reading the headlines, but the truth is all the problems are very well known about. None of this is sneaking up on anyone, and I still think it's somewhat in control for the majority of Europe.
But there are people who are talking about this being the next Lehman Brothers. Now, I know we've heard that before, but
sure.
Could this be the next Lehman?
You know, there's something called the recency effect, where people look at something traumatic and everything coming up in front of it looks like it's the next so-and-so. I think rather than this being the next Lehman Brothers, really what we're looking at, not to be too cute, is the first breakup of the EMU. Hmm. And it looks like that's pretty likely to play out.
That almost seems scarier.
In some ways, and for certain people and certain investors, it may be. But if we know about all these problems and it looks inevitable, the sooner we accept that, we can get a little bit more constructive. It's not going to be pretty. But once again, I don't think anyone will be surprised when it finally happens.
Josh Brown, investment advisor at Fusion Analytics. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
So how do the Greeks feel about this? Well, let's go now to John Syropoulos. He is a journalist, and he joins us from Athens. Good morning.
Good morning.
Does it look less likely or more likely that Greece is going to default on its debt?
I would say less likely, because it's a sign of reassurance from Europe's two main Eurozone powers that they are lending their support to Greece and expressing concern about the Greek reform program. The Greek public is extremely worried about the possibility of a default or an exit from the euro, and this sort of contact with European leaders is reassuring.
Well, what about that idea of an exit from the euro? Is that looking like a real possibility?
It's something that both the European leaders and the Greek government vehemently deny is anywhere on the horizon. However, as the German weekly magazine Der Spiegel revealed earlier this week in an article, the German finance ministry has been working on contingency planning for the possibility of a Greek default and what effect that might have on the euro, which the German government did not subsequently deny. So outside of the official statements, these fears are being seen as a possibility in the midterm future.
What does it feel like to be Greek right now? I mean, I imagine you're not too popular amongst your European neighbors.
I think many of my fellow Greeks that I speak to feel very embarrassed about the image that Greece has now acquired in the world. But mostly, most people feel very concerned about their children's future, because the crisis, it is now fully understood, is long term. And what people are afraid of is that they will lose middle class status and that the Greek economy as a whole will simply drop off the world map for about 10 years. And they are seriously thinking about sending their children abroad.
John Syropoulos, a journalist in Athens, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Wholesale prices didn't go anywhere in August because the government's producer price index saw a hike in food prices but a drop in energy prices. More people applied for home loans last week as interest rates stayed near rock bottom. Avis Budget Group says it no longer is going to try to buy dollar thrifty because of market conditions. That's going to open things up for Hertz to pursue dollar thrifty.
Meanwhile, Toyota says its production in North America is back up to full capacity 6 months after the earthquake and tsunami in Japan caused a worldwide slowdown. And Steve, by the way, they thought that it was going to take until the end of the year to bring the North American production back up to full capacity. So a little ahead of schedule from Toyota.
Ahead of schedule, exactly. You can check the numbers, by the way, anytime at our website, marketplace.org. You can follow our show, by the way, on Facebook and Twitter as well. We're at Marketplace Radio. And I'm on Twitter at Radio Chio.
And I am at Jeremy Hobson.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
A group of corporate leaders, including General Electric CEO Jeffrey Immelt and Microsoft Chairman Bill Gates, has a message for politicians in Washington. We're not spending nearly enough money researching new energy technology. The group is called the American Energy Innovation Council, and its members met with lawmakers from both parties on Capitol Hill yesterday. We are pleased to be joined now by a member of the council, Bill Gates. Welcome to Marketplace.
Great to be here.
Well, what exactly are you asking Washington to do?
Well, a group of business leaders came together to say that the investment in energy research is much lower than it needs to be, whether it's for getting low-cost energy or securing our energy supply or reducing environmental damage. We need breakthroughs. And the government funds research in a lot of areas, but in the case of energy, it's very low. And so we said that playing their key role, that's got to be increased by about $8 billion a year.
But that's a pretty big thing to ask for at a time when they're facing big trillion-dollar budget deficits.
Well, if you look at the country's challenges in terms of the trade deficit and the impact that has on the economy, energy spending is a big factor there. And, you know, I do think investing in the future is important at all times. The U.S. is by far the best at doing this type of innovation. It's the support of our universities and startups, national laboratories that really put us in position to make breakthroughs that will help meet the world's energy needs, but also create great companies and great jobs here.
When I think of the philanthropic work that you do and your foundation does, I think of things like education and healthcare. What got you so interested in energy research?
Well, energy is very important no matter where you live on the planet. The long-term implications of not making changes are very dire. But the poorest people are the ones who are the most hurt by the high cost of energy. They want to buy fertilizer. They want to have lights at night. They want to have a stove to cook their food. They want to be able to get to their job. And so if we can make innovations in this space, the best impact goes to the people our foundation thinks about all the time. And yet it needs to be done using the kind of scientific research backing that's been used to create the IT industry and medical breakthroughs, places the U.S. really has led the way.
But a lot of the ideas that involve investment right now involve public-private partnerships. How do you get the private sector on board for something like this?
Well, the energy research includes a basic research component that would need to be government-funded. But as soon as you get past the conceptual level, as you're starting to pilot things, then both venture capital and other private capital come in. And so there's a part of this energy budget called ARPA-E, where they look at really top technologies, they have contests, and then they require that private money come in to match their money. And that's a very well-run program. In fact, there's a debate about what level that should be. In our report, we say that alone should go up to $1 billion, but the current budget debate is between $180 million and $250 million.
Now, you're calling for all this increase in energy research funding here in the United States. You travel all over the world. How do we rank at this point when it comes to our funding of research for energy?
Well, the quality of research in the U.S. is absolutely the best. The research funding we give to other areas like medicine and information technologies is the best in the world. In energy, we're not the leader in funding because it's less than 0.5% of the overall market. In fact, compared to every other area, it's funded at quite a low level, which given the important issues that it touches on, including overall competitiveness of all kinds of products because they use electricity in their manufacture, it's just short-sighted not to be doing more.
Give us a sense of what you think is possible if the kind of investment in energy research that you would like actually takes place. 10, 15 years from now, what do we have?
Well, the goal is not to pick a particular technology, but there's no doubt that in the solar area, with a variety of different approaches, there should be breakthroughs to make that quite economic. In the wind area, even using today's energy sources, making them less expensive and finding ways to take the pollution and the CO2 out of those and make sure it's not causing a problem. These are the kind of tough challenges that researchers absolutely can solve if they get the right level of backing.
If President Obama is replaced next year by one of his Republican rivals, let's say Rick Perry or Mitt Romney, do you think that you could convince them to go along with something like this?
Well, the hope is that investment in research is not a partisan issue, that believing we have the best scientists, that helps create leading companies because we back those scientists. We've seen it play out in the personal computer and software field. We've seen it play out in the medical industries. The one that there's a real question on is in the energy business. And so I hope that we can get broad consensus, even though the budget is more of a challenge today than it's ever been.
Finally, since so much of Washington's ability to make these kinds of investments hinge on the state of the economy, how would you rate Washington's handling of the economy?
Well, I'm not an economist. All of us wish that the more jobs were being created, and there's a lot of talk about how best to do that. Certainly innovation, if you take the right time frame, is the reason why I'm optimistic that we will see improvements both in the economy and the the type of goods that get made. It's easy to underestimate innovation and what it means. But in the near term, we're in the hands of the what the economists and politicians can do. As you move out in time, if you fund innovation, then you can be very optimistic about where things go.
Bill Gates, who is in a push for more investment in energy research. Mr. Gates, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, meanwhile, the labor contract between the United Auto Workers Union and the big three American automakers expires tonight at midnight, and there probably won't be a new one in place come tomorrow morning. The contract talks affect wages and benefits for more than 100,000 workers, but no word yet from Chrysler or General Motors. Ford and the union have signaled they plan to keep talking. Michigan Radio's Tracy Samilton has more now from Detroit.
Ford is the only Detroit car company that faces the possibility of a strike. The UAW agreed not to strike GM and Chrysler as part of their bankruptcies in 2009. But union president Bob King says that doesn't change his approach to the talks. He wants more union jobs and a better standard of living for workers, but he says he's not willing to see high labor costs erode the profits of the Detroit Three.
So we've got to be smart and creative, finding ways to increase income without creating a competitive disadvantage.
That's why King is open to profit sharing and bonuses tied to quality instead of an across-the-board cost of living increase. But that stance rankles some of the rank and file. Gary Walkowicz is with the UAW Bargaining Committee at a Ford plant in Dearborn. He thinks Ford can afford a pay hike.
They're profitable to the extent that Ford Motor Company made, I think, $6.2 billion last year, which was one of the most profitable years ever.
Walkowicz thinks workers are ready to walk off the job if there's no pay hike in the next contract. But Kristen Dechek of the Center for Automotive Research says the possibility of a strike is remote.
There have been dissident groups in the UAW for as long as the UAW has been around. And very rarely do they change policy dramatically.
Ford Motor Company wouldn't comment on the status of the negotiations, but the talks at General Motors and Chrysler could end suddenly. Either the companies or the union can demand binding arbitration after tonight's deadline. I'm Tracy Samilton for Marketplace.
Well, Steve, now it's time for something a little bit lighter. You know, it's been a heavy news day for us today.
Yeah, a lot of things going on. Exactly.
You know, let's go on vacation here for a moment. North Korea has had a hard time getting
tourists. To North Korea? Is that where we're going? To North Korea?
Yeah,
great.
Right. Well, they've had a very hard time getting tourists to come and visit. It could be because of the cold weather, or it could also be because of the random nuclear tests and the authoritarian regime there.
Right.
I don't know. But what I do know is that they have just launched a cruise ship, which is not exactly like the
cruise ships.
Not cruise
missiles?
That,
cruise ship?
Is the cruise ship, yes. They're going a different direction. And they're not really like the cruise ships that roam the Caribbean. According to a journalist who recently took a ride, the water faucets don't work. The cabins, let's say they have a little old world charm. They're dorm-like, is how they were described. And they also take away your cell phones when you make a stop on shore.
Oh,
so
that's not good. Yeah,
no
that's
pictures.
Not good at all.
But the all-you-can-eat buffet... I'm just being told that they don't have one of those either.
Yeah, lovely cruise. President Obama today travels to North Carolina to pitch his American Jobs Bill. He's looking for support in the business community, and he's looking for support in Congress. Well, the government really has only a couple of ways to jumpstart the economy, through fiscal and monetary policy. They're very different and often confused for one another. Marketplace senior editor and Whiteboard host Patty Hirsch is in now to give us a little primer. Hey, Patty.
Hi, Steve.
So fiscal and monetary policy, what's the difference between the two?
Well, they're both ways that the government stimulates the economy, but fiscal policy is what the government does directly. That's tax, spend, and borrow. And it does this through the Treasury. Monetary policy is what the Fed does.
The Fed, the Federal Reserve.
Right. So the Fed uses various methods to keep money flowing through the system at just the right rate to keep inflation low and to keep people employed.
But isn't the Fed part of the government?
Yeah, but not in the way the Treasury is. Have you seen the movie The Godfather?
Well, of course, yes.
So you know who Tom Hagen is, right?
He was the consigliere, right?
Right. Yeah, he advises the family on how to run their business. Well, in the government, the Treasury Secretary is like the consigliere. He advises the President and the Congress on how much to tax, how much to spend, and, of course, how much to borrow when they run short. So once the government decides what to do, the Treasury, they do the business.
All right. So who's the Fed?
The Fed is Luca Brasi.
Oh, the assassin.
Yeah. So Luca, right, is not a fully paid up member of the family. They contract him. They have oversight of what he does. And he checks in with them now and again. But otherwise, he has a pretty free hand to do the business of the family, if you like, using the various tools at his disposal. Right. Well, the Fed is pretty similar to that. The governors are appointed and overseen by Congress, but they can use any of the tools that they have.
So what are those tools? I mean, we're not talking piano wire and guns here, are we?
No, no. But the Fed's instruments are pretty blunt as well. You know, it adjusts interest rates. It lends to banks. It makes the banks hold certain amounts of reserves at the Fed. And this is all to keep money flowing through the system. The problem is it's used all of those tools and we're still not moving. So right now, the Fed looks a bit like Luca Brasi standing in the street with like a bent knife and a busted hammer and an empty gun, and the target's still coming.
So that's it?
Well, no. I mean, the Fed may be out of the picture, but the Congress still has options. The problem is that the Congress, in order to get anything done, taxing, spending, and raising money,
right,
they're going to have to agree. And just like a family of warring mafiosi, right now they're not agreeing on anything.
Marketplace's senior editor and whiteboard guy. And you've got a whiteboard
on this,
yeah,
right? We've got a whiteboard on this. It's all there at marketplace.org. You can check it out.
Patty Hirsch, thanks.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Word today from the government that retail sales were flat in August. Disappointing, since August is a big month for the back-to-school crowd. Retailers look at those numbers to get a clue about what to expect for holiday sales, as Sally Herships reports.
Predicting trends in fashion or the fashion business can be tricky. Erica Mashmeyer is a retail analyst at R.W. Baird. She says August sales numbers may help retailers figure out what to expect next.
The retailers that we've seen doing well and gaining market share will continue to do well and gain market share. And players that have been struggling, it's going to be very hard for them to turn things around in this environment.
Those who are doing well so far, high-end stores like Neiman, Marcus, and Macy's. Those who are struggling, retailers like Kohl's and JCPenney, who cater to more budget shoppers. But, says James Fallon, editor at Women's Wear Daily, the holiday season could bridge the gap. He says even with all the craziness in the markets, consumers aren't panicking.
A, consumers are used to it. B, retailers have figured out how to market to them. And C, retailers have gotten their operations very much into line with consumer demand.
So Fallon says, even if the holiday season isn't great, it still could be okay. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Finally this morning, a collectible store in Las Vegas is selling, Jeremy, a piece of literary history on eBay. If you have $50,000 spare dollars in your pocket, if you've got money burning a hole, you can buy a note written by the late reclusive author J.D. Salinger to his maid.
Uh-huh.
Yes, the memo instructs the housekeeper to get her work done before she goes on vacation because he, quote, doesn't want to be bothered with insignificant things.
Wow.
It's formally signed J.D. Salinger. It's not like J.D. or, you know,
J.
Yeah,
or
J.
Sally.
Or, yeah, or whatever. Yeah, even some initials would have been nice. But no, J.D. Salinger is how he signed this note to his housekeeper. While the note itself will cost you a fortune, Jeremy, that insight into his personality, free of charge. Thank you.
It's nice that we give our listeners a little free of charge tidbits here on the Marketplace Midday Update.
That's what we try and do all the time. In Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiatakis.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.